I've entitled my talk to you, the sermon, Real Questions, Real Answers. And in the next few moments that we have together, I'm going to look at three common objections that skeptics and maybe, actually I would suggest to you, Christians have when it comes to faith. Real life questions, questions that for some of us might even keep us up at night. Now, before I get into that, I just want to tell you a bit about my own story, because I think to every speaker, there's a biography. Now, I grew up, actually, in a small city called St. Catharines in Ontario. I'm sure some of you are familiar with that city, but it's just between Toronto and Niagara Falls there. And I grew up in a Christian home. Actually, I was very clued up on what it looked like, at least, to go to church. I remember as a youngster going to church on Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday night for some event, and then Friday evening for some youth for a youth event. So I knew church very well. And if you were to talk to me as an early teenager, I would have probably told you that I was a very well-seasoned Christian. But I actually wasn't in terms of knowing God personally. I knew what to do when I was at church, but I actually didn't have a relationship with him. And in those days, when I was a teenager in early high school, my parents were looking for a church. They were moving churches, and we were at this one church I had never been to before, and something very strange happened. Someone came up to me and talked to me at church. Now, that was strange for two reasons. One, no one ever actually talked to me at church, okay? But it was more than that. The guy who talked to me was cool, and I didn't know many cool people at church, so this was a bit of a showstopper for me. He talked to me and he asked me to if I would like to come to the youth group. And now, I don't know if you've ever been in a conversation in which you agree to do something, maybe 2 or 3 minutes after which you realize, no, hold on, I didn't want to do that. I committed to something and I didn't want to do that. Well, that's what happened in this case. I was sort of in a daze because, one, a guy's talking to me at church, and two, this is a really cool guy. And he asked me to go to youth group. I committed to go to youth group, only to realize that I committed to it when I was driving home in the car with my parents from church. So I sort of felt duped, but I felt, hey, look, I committed to this. So I a week later, I went to the youth group with a few of my friends. And youth group was normal, you know, in terms of what I knew it to be. A lot of songs, and you played crazy games, and you had food that you had, but I'll never forget standing in this room when we sang songs that evening, because I experienced something that I never before realized. As we sang songs, I looked around and I saw that the people, some of whom were my peers, these students were actually singing to God. And I never realized that before. You see, I knew what it was like to sing about God, but all these students were singing as if God was in the room. And if I were to describe to you what I realized that evening, I think I would put it in those terms. God was in the room. And in that moment, I will never forget encountering him. So today, I can say that if I were not a Christian, I could tell you that I don't like it, or I don't want it to be true, but there's no way I can tell you, I could tell you in my heart of hearts, that I don't think it's true, because in that moment I knew it was true. God was real. And I moved from this place of understanding God as a set of ideas to be understood, just knowing about him, to knowing him personally. And there's a huge difference, worlds apart difference from knowing about God. You can know a lot about God, but that is very different to knowing him personally. And that is the Christian faith. We see in the priestly prayer in the Gospels, Jesus says, and this is eternal life. This is eternal life, that they know you, the one true God, Jesus Christ. That is what the Christian life is. And this is, you know, this has really taken me into what I do today, traveling around across the globe telling people about the amazing news of who Jesus is. Now, for me, I would say that it started, my life with Christ started with an encounter and led me to questions. But for others, it's the questions that often lead to Christ. But either way, there comes a point at which you will be asking questions. It might be, in some cases, something that leads you to an encounter with Christ. For some of us, it might actually, as soon as we have this encounter with Christ, we start asking questions. I want to look at three questions. And let me begin by telling you a story. A few years ago, I was speaking at a university in the south of England, and actually a group of us from our team, we host university missions, and university missions for us means a large group of our team just arrive on a university campus, and we're there for 1 week and just do a lot of interaction with students, asking them questions, they ask us questions, we're giving talks. And this was that case a few years ago, speaking at a university there. And I remember that, just talking to one student who was interested in coming to our event. But the problem for him was science. He looked at me, and we actually sat down and had a cup of coffee, and he said, you know, I would consider it, but I feel like if I were to go to this event and, you know, get really interested in it, I'd have to give up my, for one, you know, my passion for science, and also that's my major here. He was majoring in the sciences at this university. And we began to talk, and he had many questions, but for him, he felt that holding to his passion in the sciences almost went against belief in God. Now, there are many ways in which that can be nuanced. For some, it's, well, there are just many ways, many layers to the science and God debate, so to speak. But let me just put the question like this, because there are many different ways of nuancing it, but often it comes down to this. Isn't science and faith, are the two not contradictory? That is often the question. Are science and faith, are they not contradictory? So let me just outline for you. I'm going to just give you a few points here for what Christianity has to say. First, we have to ask the question, hold on, what is science and what is faith? We have to define the terms here. Now, faith, it's very interesting. Faith, as Richard Dawkins, who's a very well-known atheist out of England, he has popularized the definition of faith as being believing in someone or something that does not exist. Faith is believing in someone or something that does not exist. And nothing could be further from the truth of what the biblical definition of faith is, because the biblical definition of faith is fundamentally a response to reality. When we say we have faith in God, we're actually saying, one, he's real. Two, you can trust him. And more than that, the Christian faith is evidence-based belief. Christian faith is evidence-based belief. Now just hold that thought for a moment. The idea of faith in Christianity is actually evidence-based. Trust, response to reality. In science, you know, if you talk to people in the sciences, whether they're studying, whether they're practitioners, there's a great and long dialogue as to what science is. But what is fundamental and what is not really disputed is this, that science, at its core, is a willingness to follow empirical evidence wherever it leads. That is what science is at its core. There's this willingness, there has to be this willingness to follow empirical evidence wherever it leads. Now, just hold that for a moment. Following the evidence where it leads, and then Christianity, faith, that is evidence-based belief. In one sense, you start seeing slowly, they're actually not as antithetical. To be more specific, they are not antithetical just by looking at those two terms, faith and science. So we need to define the terms. Second, I think it helps to look at what's the origin of science? What are the roots of science? Because often people at the popular level will say, well, you have all these people who are practicing science or doing science, but it's not a Christian thing. It's been sort of secularized. But just by looking at the origin, the roots of science, you see that actually many people who we would consider the bastions of scientific learning were practicing and exploring different ideas in the sciences, not despite of their faith, but because of it. We have people like Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Pascal, the list goes on. These people, again, were not practicing science and closing their eyes to their faith. No, they were going in, eyes wide open to their faith. Actually, many would say it was their faith that inspired them for scientific learning. Listen to the words of C.S. Lewis. He pinpoints this very well. He says, "Men became scientific because they expected law and nature. They expected law and nature because they believed in a lawgiver." Speaking of the origin of science, C.S. Lewis says this: "Men became scientific because they expected law and nature. They expected law and nature because they believed in a lawgiver." Even when you look to the roots of science, you see actually Christianity provided this platform and the inspiration on which many would go into the sciences. We need to define the terms, then understand the origin of science, and then thirdly, understand the limits of science. And this language, the limits of science, comes from the Nobel laureate, Sir Peter Medawar. This is what Peter Medawar said. "The existence of a limit to science is, however, made clear by its inability to answer childlike elementary questions having to do with first and last things. Questions such as, how did everything begin? What are we all here for? What is the point of living?" What is he saying? He's saying, look, science is brilliant at answering certain questions. But then there are questions actually that are just not part of scientific learning. There are limits. And by the way, he's not attacking or slagging science there. He's just saying this is what science does and this is what science does not do. Science actually does not answer the how did everything begin question. Science cannot answer the what am I here for? What was I made for question. And that's not attacking science, just saying, look, this is what it does and this is what it does not do. Science is very good, to put it one way, perhaps overly simple, but science is very good at answering the how questions, but not necessarily the why question. Is science and faith, are these two things contradictory? I would suggest to you no. From a Christian standpoint, we can say with great confidence and also be encouraged by this that actually when you look to the terms, what does it mean to have faith in God? What does science mean? The origin of science and then to the limit of science, you see that actually the two are not antithetical. They actually have been historically brilliant and dynamic partners. There's this dynamic partnership. Let me tell you another story. I was speaking at a small church in Canada a few years ago, and I'll never forget, it was this church, the church that I was speaking at, it was their anniversary. And they had a barbecue after the service, and while everyone was filing out, they were slowly turning the lights off. A guy came to me and he said, "Hey, you spoke on the problem of evil this morning, but you only touched on it briefly. I would like to talk to you about that." And then he looked at me and said, "Because I know something about it. I know what it's like." And it really struck me, you know, and now it's just this man and me sitting near the stage in this room. Everyone has nearly left the room there. They're turning off the lights. And I said, "Before I say anything, can I just ask you to share something of your story?" And he said to me, "Let me share this with you. Approximately 18 years ago, my wife and I lost our son, our 6-year-old son, in a car accident. And we haven't recovered from it. We don't know what to do." And he said, "I have many friends who look to me and they don't know why I still go to church after everything that's happened." And then he looked at me and said, "What do you have to say about that?" What do you say to that? Massive question. And here's where we see the complexity of questions. Questions do not only come from an intellectual level, where there's intellectual curiosity sparking the question. You have here the emotional level, this heart level. There's a crisis going on, maybe tragedy, maybe loss, that is motivating the question. I looked at him and I actually first said to him, my wife and I, we had just lost someone very close to us. We were going through a time of loss, so I said, look, I understand something of what this is, what you might be going through. Grief is different for everybody, but I know something of what you're going through, and I'm deeply sorry for what you have had to endure. Now, in the next few moments here, I just want to share with you and sketch out for you what I said to this man in that conversation. The first thing I said was this. There's no way we can just... this is not going to be a one-stop shop answer. I talked to him for maybe just under an hour, but still, that's not going to actually just fully answer the question. But after saying that to him, I said, look, if you want an answer to what Christianity has to say to this question, I would say first, Christianity is not the only faith or system of belief that needs to answer this question. Every faith, system of belief, religion, whether you adhere to one faith, or you would say no faith, or you adhere to multiplicity of faiths, no one's off the hook. No one escapes. Everyone must have an answer to this question. And the question then is, what worldview, so to speak, what faith best explains and makes sense of our observations and our longings when it comes to this question? So then I said, look, you have Eastern faiths. Many streams of Eastern thought would actually call what has happened to you illusory. In other words, the pain that you're experiencing is an illusion. And by the way, this is not attacking Eastern faiths. This is what many Eastern faiths hold to. But I remember talking to one of my professors about this. And he said to me, if the pain I'm experiencing is an illusion, well, it's a very painful illusion. It's not helpful, actually. That answer is not helpful at a felt level. I looked at him and I said, look, Christianity looks at what's happened to you and says, no, it is not illusory. What has happened to you is real. It's real. But more than that, Christianity looks at this premature death of your son and says, that is wrong. That is wrong. But I said, not every faith will actually tell you that. When we look to hardline atheism, what I mean by that is people who truly believe that there is no God. Now, stick with me. This is going to be slightly technical here. But as soon as you remove God from life, you remove the objective point of reference by which you can actually say something is right or wrong. You lose that significant means by which you can say something is right or wrong. And what you are left with when you actually are a person who truly believes there is no God, what you're left with is only just preference. What you are left with is, I don't like that. And by the way, there have been atheists who have gone on the microphone, on live radio, and have said this to questions of rape. They said, look, I cannot say that this is wrong, but I can say I do not like it. Rape, murder, bullying, manipulation, hardline atheism cannot tell you that something like this death of his son, it will not tell you that that is wrong. And I looked at this man and I said, Christianity looks at you and says, that's wrong. What happened to your son? That is wrong. And it's also real. But Christianity goes even further. It says, yes, the problem is real. Yes, the problem is wrong. But more than that, God has gotten involved in it. That means that when we talk to God, when we interact with him, we're relating to a God who actually knows what this problem is like intimately. He understands. So Christianity, as I just said a few moments ago, is a response to reality. And in this case, Christianity tells us that the world is not right. There's a sense of disorder. There is disorder, not only outside in the natural world, but inside the human heart. There is disorder. There's a sense of wrongness. And that's the world into which Jesus came. And when Jesus comes, there's a brilliant story, a very poignant story in John 11, in which Jesus hears of his friend Lazarus dying. He gets word from his friends that Lazarus is dying, and he looks to his disciples who are there in a separate town, and he says, look, we need to go see Lazarus in this other town, Bethany, because he's dying. And they make their way to see Lazarus, but they're too late. Many of you know this story. They get there. Jesus is too late. Jesus' friends come to him and say, look, you're too late. And I'm paraphrasing now. They're basically saying to him, look, if you came sooner, you could have done something about it. But Lazarus is dead now. And they're sobbing. They're weeping. The Christian response, first and foremost, to pain, suffering, evil in this world, it begins with tears. It begins with tears. Jesus, in your pain, there's so many ways in which we might experience pain. Mental pain, physical, psychological, spiritual. No matter the pain that we experience, Jesus does not look to you and correct you. He weeps with you. Jesus is sad. He is profoundly sad at what happens to Lazarus. But more than that, in that narrative, John, who's narrating the story, he uses in the Greek there three times the word, the term that we get in English, it would be furious indignation. John uses that term to describe Jesus' feelings and thoughts toward this premature death of his friend Lazarus. So Jesus is not only profoundly sad at what has happened, he's also indignant. He is angry. Why? Why is Jesus angry? Jesus is angry, I think, when you look at the passage, when you look at the whole of Scripture, because he looks at this premature death of his friend Lazarus. He looks around and he says, this is not the way it was meant to be. This is not the way the world was meant to be. And what's truly remarkable is Jesus, in a matter of moments, he actually does raise Lazarus from the dead. And then just not too long after that, when Jesus actually goes to the cross, takes on the enormity of sin and death and defeats it. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that actually, yes, suffering and pain is real. It's wrong. God has gotten involved in the problem. But the cross and the resurrection tell us this. The world that is, we know as we look around in this world, disorder, brokenness, damage, the world that is not the world that will be. That's what the cross and resurrection tell us. The world that is not the world that will be. When Christ comes back, we have this, when the Lord comes back, we have this language of every tear will be wiped away. There'll be restoration, there'll be renewal. The world that is not the world that will be. So where do we go from here? Because there are dark times. For many of us in this room, we have experienced dark times. We might be actually going through a dark time right now. In the future, we might encounter dark times. What do we do about that? I want to suggest to you that, as one of my colleagues, Oz Guinness, says, we can trust God in the dark because we are not in the dark about God. We can trust God in the dark because we are not in the dark about God. He has revealed himself. He has revealed himself to us in the person of Jesus Christ. And just as a side note here, this is a distinguishing factor of the Christian faith. In other faiths, you have instructions. You have people pointing to instructions, but in the Christian faith, you have a person. In Islam, for instance, as a side note, Islam does not reveal God in a person. Do you want the revelation of God in Islam? The revelation of God is the Holy Quran. It's a book. But the revelation of God in Christianity is not an instruction manual. It's not a book. It's found in a person, a God who can be known. Do you know that? Do you know his presence? Now, let's just stop there for a moment. Because even this point of Jesus Christ is challenged, and it's challenged when we actually look to history. And it's very interesting, even though this is, for scholars, not even a talking point, for many people, now especially speaking now to those of you who might be young professional or university students or high school students, this is an area where many of you might be getting mocked. It doesn't necessarily come at an intellectual level, but people say, man, how can you believe that Jesus ever actually lived? And you're talking about, you just keep going on about Jesus Christ, but we have no proof that he ever lived. And plus, we could never know that he lived. It was like over 2,000 years ago. You know, I'll never forget I worked for the Toronto Blue Jays ground crew for 4 years, and I loved every day I worked on the ground crew. Now, ground crew is a very professional way of saying we were people who worked with dirt and clay. That's what we did. But every day we had field repairs, and I remember working at home plate there in Toronto at the Rogers Centre, and we were doing these field repairs, and my colleague looked at me and said, "Nathan, I respect what you believe. I respect the way you live. But there's one thing you believe that I can never believe. And it's this whole idea that Jesus Christ actually lived." And he looked at me and said, "Look, because if I have it right, Christians believe that Jesus Christ was an actual person, what, around 2,000 years ago. Is that right?" And I said, "Yes, that is correct. That is what Christians believe." And he said, "So what do you say to that? There's no way we can believe that." Now, how's that for a question? Now, we're not exactly in an academic environment. We're at a baseball stadium, and we're working with clay and dirt. So I wasn't anticipating this kind of question. So I had to give it a bit of a think. I looked to him, and I said, "Imagine if the Blue Jays win the World Series this year. It would be glorious, absolutely glorious." Now, this is back in 2007. We know, you know, if you're a Blue Jays fan, you know what it's like the past couple years. I said, 2007, could you imagine World Series champions? Fast forward 20 years, you and I come down to the stadium with our sons. We have field-level seats, and you and I start waxing about the good old days when the Blue Jays won the World Series, and our sons break out into uncontrollable laughter. And they say, "Yeah, right, Blue Jays, World Series, yeah, right, they're so horrible. No way they could ever win the World Series." And we get increasingly indignant. And we say, "Yes, they did. They did win the World Series." And then we say, look up at the banners. You see the banner, 2007 World Series champions, Toronto Blue Jays. To which our sons say, "Well, anybody, you just need enough money to pay for a banner to put that up in the stadium." And then we say this, "We were there. We were as close to the action as you can get without being in the action. We were right there, down there in the photo bay where the photographers, where the security people are." I said to my colleague, "That would be pretty compelling, wouldn't it?" Now, what I didn't realize I was doing in that moment is what many historians do when they want to know the trustworthiness, or a term that they would use, the veracity of stories from antiquity, from the Bible, from the New Testament. How do we know Jesus Christ was an actual historical person? Well, let me just start here. We don't even, just put the Bible aside, okay? Even though scholars looked at the Gospels as very credible, and especially also the Gospels and also Paul as very credible. And by the way, not just Christian conservative, skeptical scholars look to Paul and the Gospels as very credible accounts of Jesus, the life and teaching of Jesus. But I'm not even going to use the Bible here for a moment. We have, outside the Bible, historians, first century historians, just going with a couple here, you have Josephus, who I'm sure some of you are aware of, first century Jewish historian who mentions Jesus Christ. A Roman historian by the name of Tacitus also mentions Jesus Christ and what's happening in the Roman Empire, how this is causing a stir. Now, here's the thing. I'm just going to come out with it. I don't think there's anybody who actually has a PhD or who's teaching or who is interested in ancient history who will dispute the fact that Jesus Christ was an actual person in first century Palestine. A friend of our ministry, a guy by the name of John Dixon, who, by the way, has his PhD in ancient history, he's in Australia, he, a few years ago, put on his Facebook page, he said, "If there's anybody who holds a post at a university in ancient history, or who has a PhD in ancient history, who actually does not believe Jesus Christ ever lived, please make yourself known. And as soon as you do, I will eat a page out of my Bible." How's that? That's really good dare. Well, he has not touched his Bible in terms of eating it. He has not eaten one page of there because no one has been able to come forward. Even skeptical scholars, a guy by the name of Bart Ehrman, who is indeed, he's not a Christian. He debates Christians on the historicity of the Christian faith. He will actually call people out when they say, oh, we can't believe Jesus was a person. He was on a live radio station with another skeptic one time. And in this live radio interview, the skeptic said, well, we know Jesus Christ never lived. And Bart, being a skeptical scholar, remember, he's a skeptical guy, he looked at him and said, hold on. Did you just say you don't believe Jesus Christ ever lived? He said, no, of course we know. Everyone knows Jesus Christ never lived. And Bart said, of course he lived. We have all this evidence. It's not even disputed. You have all of a sudden a skeptical guy calling out the other skeptic saying, where are you coming from? We have too much evidence. Come on, we have to move on. There are other issues we're going to fight, but we can't fight that. We know Jesus Christ is an actual person, whether you're religious, whether you're Christian or not. Jesus lives. So even skeptical scholars will say that. So how do we know he was an actual person in history? One, we have people who are outside of the Bible, extra-biblical sources that tell us that Jesus lived. But historians also want to know, does what we have of Jesus in the gospel, does it match up to the historical context of first century Palestine? Does it match up to real places, villages, cities, roads, lakes, mountains? Does it match up with what we have in the gospels, does it match up with customs of the first century? Passover, purity, Sabbath, divorce, law. Does it match up with the institutions, the synagogue and temple? And here's the thing, when you put the gospels to the test, they come through with flying colors. Now here's the point, when we speak about the existence of Jesus Christ, the New Testament telling of Jesus is not primarily concerned with telling us that he existed. The New Testament assumes that. The Gospels assume that Jesus lived. The Gospels are actually concerned with explaining who Jesus is. A professor of mine was a guy named Alistair McGrath, who's a prolific author when it comes to theology and also books on theology and science. He says this, look, the Gospels are like a detective story. You know, detective novels that, you know, look at the whodunit. Except the Gospels are a who is he. That's what the Gospels are. Who is he? So the money question we have to ask when we read the Gospels is not, did Jesus live? The Gospels aren't actually asking that question. They assume that. They're giving biographical sketches of who Jesus is. The question we need to ask now is, who is Jesus Christ? If you want to understand the Christian God, if you want to understand what God is like, you need to get to know Jesus Christ. Colossians gives us this language of Jesus Christ being the image of the invisible God. So he is a great who he is a God who is great, almighty. He holds all things together. But he's also a God who's come close, who's personal. So I'm just going to ask you a question. How do you see God today? This morning, how do you view God? When you view God, is there sadness? Is there frustration? Is there anxiety? Is there comfort? Is there hope? 20th century author and pastor A.W. Tozer said, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. What comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. How do you think about God? What comes into your mind when you think about God? He is a God who is great, sovereign. He holds all things together, but he's also a God who's come close. There's this passage in Matthew's gospel in Matthew 14. You'll remember this when Jesus walks on the water. And at first, when the disciples see it, it's approximately 3 a.m. Fourth watch of the night, as the gospel would say. It's between 3 to 6 a.m. They've been out on the water. They are afraid for their lives, even though these guys, and that tells us something because these guys knew the water very well. They are afraid for their lives. They see Jesus. They think he's a ghost. And Jesus comes to them. Talks to them, invites Peter to walk on the water, Peter does. But then he starts sinking. Peter calls out. He cries out to Jesus, "Save me." Jesus reaches out his hand. Try to catch the imagery here. Jesus reaches out his hand to Peter, and then he takes hold of him. The God of Christianity is not only one who is transcendent, sovereign, in control, but he's also a God who takes hold of your hand and embraces you, holds you tight. Do you know that embrace today? Let me close with a personal story. Approximately a year ago, my father died suddenly. And it was completely shocking for us. I have three sisters. And, of course, my mom is still living in completely shocking that my dad would die. And you have a lot of time to think about what you miss about that person that was so dear to you. And when I think about my dad, I think about two things. One, I miss him. Not necessarily what he would say, but just him being there. You know, I'm sure some of you, many of you in this room, you might have one or two, or maybe more, maybe a few friends who you would say, it's not necessarily what they say, but actually just being with them that brings comfort. For my dad, it was that. I just liked being with him. But I also miss his voice. There was a strength and a vivacity to my dad's voice that brought a lot of comfort. And I realized that a couple months actually after my dad died, that I still had a voicemail on my phone from my dad. And frequently, I still have it on the phone. And I'll listen to it. And there have been times when I play my dad's voicemail, and then I play it again. And then I play it again. And I play it again. I just keep playing this voicemail. Why am I doing that? I'm playing it because that's my dad's voice. It's my father's voice, but he's speaking to me. In the Christian faith, we have a God who's actually with us. The hope I have with my father dying is that the Christian hope is distinct and clear in this. I'll see him again. But I miss his presence now. And I miss his voice. The Christian God is not only one who is sovereign and great, but he's one who takes a hold of your hand. He embraces you. He speaks to you. And he's with you. Do you know that embrace? This morning, do you know his voice? Do you know his presence? One of the wonderful things of Christianity is not only that, yes, we have answers to these questions, and they come at a theoretical level often, but they also come at an emotional level. And Christianity responds loud and clear and says we can have confidence in the gospel and in a God who has come close. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much. I pray for each person here. We all come from different places, different concerns, different joys, different highs, different lows. In all of this, Lord, I pray that your presence would be made known. I pray for the person here who has questions and maybe would say, I don't hear God's voice. I wish that were true. I pray that you'd speak to them, Lord. Help them to hear your voice. I pray for the person who would say, man, I want God's presence in my life, but I don't feel it. God, I pray that in their heart of hearts, they would know your all-surrounding presence with us. Thank you, Lord. Thank you for your love and truth and grace. In Christ's name, amen.